actually in the home stretch. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 classes left, not including the final exam.
I saw you coming, I was gonna slam the door in your face. Alright.
On one hand, you had Protestants, this protest movement, calling for various reforms, spearheaded by people like Luther and Zwingli and Calvin. Even Henry VIII got into the game. But then you had the church pushed back, counter-reformation, under the guise of Paul III, Pope Paul III. And the problem is something which all of you can appreciate. If one person has one idea, and another person has another idea, and you're unwilling to meet in the middle, conflict arises.
Yep. And that's essentially what happened. They started launching wars over how does one interpret the Bible? The Bible, the holy book of Christianity. The Bible, in which it has such controversial ideas like love thy neighbor, and to be charitable and helpful. There are references in Scripture about Jesus basically saying that you should be armed and you should defend yourself if assaulted. I don't really remember anywhere in the Bible Jesus basically saying, well, if you don't agree with me, kill them. But that's ultimately what happened, because the problem is during this time, religion was so omnipresent, it melded with politics. That's essentially what kind of happened in Switzerland. Tiny little wars of Capel. Thousands died. But it was about one guy basically trying to tell churches how to fix themselves. People agreed with them, started reforming the churches, but there were other people that said, no, we don't want to do that. But in the end, they figured it out. The Swiss figured it out. You can't justifiably kill somebody because of their beliefs. Particularly when the other side of Christians too. Literally, it was two sides of the same coin. So they came up with the ultimate solution. The leader or the government picks the religion, and they're in charge. Curios or jail. Whose rule? Eos religio. His religion. Well, had people been paying attention, that's where it would end. They had the solution. They fought, they learned their lesson, and they came up with a solution. That was viable everywhere. But the problem is people don't pay attention. Because they're caught up in their own life. Case in point. What would erupt in the center part of the continent? In the area commonly referred to as the Holy Roman Empire. In charge of the Holy Roman Empire, which at the time encompassed all of Germany, part of Poland, part of Hungary, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Austria, all the way down to northern Italy. The problem with the Holy Roman Empire, though, it was not a centralized state. It was a loose-knit confederation. And as we said before, in charge of it was, relatively speaking, a young man by the name of Charles V. Charles was in charge of hundreds of these little states, and he was tasked with essentially governing them. Sorry, I have the notes in here somewhere. There we go.
2,000 lesser nobles, 66 city-states, 100 imperial courts, 30 princes, 70 bishops, and again, an empire, like we said, that stretched from Italy all the way up to the Baltic Sea.
Plus, he also was the king of Spain, which at this time was conquering the New World.
So this dude had a lot on his plate. But, in the end, he was a devout Catholic.
Beginning in the time of the Counter-Reformation, the 1530s, all throughout the Holy Roman Empire, violence began erupting on the local level. And again, we don't have time to talk about it all, but we can make it real simple. Catholics attacked Protestants, Protestants attacked Catholics, and sometimes Protestants attacked other Protestants. Oh, and forget about the Jews. Everyone was being attacked on the local level. And mostly it was in the form of what are known as pogroms. P-O-G-R-O-M-S. Pogroms. Have you heard that word before? Kind of like mobs. Mob violence. So you would find out that someone in the village worshipped differently than you, and then a whole bunch of thugs would go down and basically assault them. And then the person who was assaulted would go and talk to his buddies, and he would get a little group, and they would go and attack the other side. Chaos. Widespread. And there was nothing the central government could do about it, again, because it was decentralized. To make matters worse, the leadership in the Protestant areas, particularly Protestant nobles, organized themselves and formed what became known as the Schmalkaldic League, which was a loose-knit alliance of these Protestant nobles. Why? Well, they recognized that the only way that they could defend their faiths was to combine their military strength to be able to push back against the king, the emperor. So, over the 1930s, not only were there localized outbreaks, but then you started having this alliance form. Armies began mobilizing. To make matters worse, the Schmalkaldic League made alliances with other European countries, the enemies of Charles V. They made an alliance in 1532 with France. And then in 1538, they made an alliance with Denmark. So literally, it was like Europe, which was once all Catholic, are now fighting this kind of like pseudo-civil war. But, as I've told you before, during this time period, war was a loosely used term and applied to when there was conflict, not necessarily battles being fought. But eventually, battles would erupt. A handful. The most violent period of the reign of Charles V took place kind of in the middle, when in 1546, the Schmalkaldic War erupted. Tens of thousands of soldiers marched on the battlefield. There were sieges. There were counter maneuvers. And there were a couple outright clashes. To make it simple, because we don't have time to get into the details of the war, in 1547, Charles essentially would win. He would capture some of the leaders of the movement, hold them ransom, and the Schmalkaldic League would submit. the winner due to the loser in a war. Whatever he wants, yeah. It's not that complicated. So what does he do? He imposes terms. And the terms were straightforward. Commonly referred to as the Augsburg Interim. Under this arrangement, Charles would issue a legal order for all peoples of the Holy Roman Empire to be Catholics. So now legally you could not be a Protestant, legally everyone had to be Catholic. But interestingly enough, Charles also practiced what's known as salutary neglect. He made a law, but he intentionally did not enforce it. Why? Well, very simple. Shortly after the Augsburg Interim, the Ottoman Turks began marching up the Balkans and essentially would invade Hungary and Austria. So Charles realized, you know something? They may be Protestant, but I need their soldiers too. Because the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So for 5 years after the Augsburg Interim, you had an alliance of sort between the Protestants and the Catholics fighting against the Turks. And the Christians kind of held their own. The Turks managed to drive the lines into Europe, but it wasn't a total defeat. So, my awesome visual. There is a map, but it's just not there yet. So here we got Spain, we got Italy, then we got the Balkans, and down here we got Turkey. And there's the Black Sea. Almost looks like it, not even close. Down here is Constantinople, the heart of the Ottoman Empire. Their armies are driving north into Austria and kind of Hungary. France, here's the Holy Roman Empire, and such. Looks just like it. Can tell I'm an art major. Well, fast forward to 1550, and the Turks are defeated. And Charles now starts trying to put pressure on the Protestant nobles to come back to Catholicism like the Augsburg Interim mandates. Well, when he started doing that, Charles would actually trigger another war, which would eventually erupt in 1552. Known as the War with Maurice of Saxony. Now, Saxony is a German state located in northern Germany. Prior to the Schmalkaldic War, the leading noble there, the Duke of Saxony, Maurice, converted to Lutheranism. But he stayed allied with Charles during the Schmalkaldic War. He was actually called Judas by the Protestants. When the Turks attacked, Maurice allowed his soldiers to join all of the other German soldiers in fighting against the Turkish hordes. But in 1550, when Charles attempts to impose Catholicism,
This angered Maurice.
And then when the king ordered Maurice to lay siege to and subdue Lutheran cities, Maurice was done. He refused. He gathered the Schmalkaldic League and the other Protestant princes and essentially would declare war on Charles. Making matter worse, he also, I think this comes up as a click. No, it does not. He also made an alliance with France. So now, you have all of northern Germany, which for the most part was Protestant, allied with Catholic France, fighting against Austria. To make matters worse, at the same time, the Turks once again invade. So here's Charles. He's getting hammered from the west. He's getting hammered from the east. He's getting hammered from the north. In the end, he was completely overwhelmed. And he would relent. During the midst of the war, he met with Maurice and agreed to what would become known as the Peace of Passau. In it, Charles pledged freedom for Lutherans. Interestingly enough, the moment this was signed, Maurice declares war on the French and gets all of the German states to agree. So now, once again, you have an alliance between the Catholics and the Protestants going against their common enemy, the French. Then, once the French were defeated, the alliance once again turned on the Turks and drove the Turks out. Once the war was over, another agreement was hammered out, and this would be finalized, and would bring about 50 years of peace to Germany. The Peace of Augsburg. Signed in 1555. This document did many things. One of which, Charles agreed to step down. He resigned being King of Spain and Holy Roman Emperor. Spain was given to his son, Philip, and the Holy Roman Emperorship was given to his younger brother, Ferdinand. But in it was this. Ferdinand, as the new Holy Roman Emperor, basically pledged Curius Regio, Eos Religio. So if you lived in a Protestant German state, you could be Protestant. If you lived in a Catholic German state, you would be Catholic. Cœlis regio, eos religio. Now, this did not result in an end in all of the localized violence, but much of it would subside. There would be no more armies marching around.
thousands died in Switzerland. Close to 100,000. I think it was like 150,000 died in the various wars of Charles V. Thousands, hundred thousands. Same solution. You think that would get people's attention? No? No. Human beings suck. Because just as the religious wars would subside in the Holy Roman Empire, they would erupt next door in France. This too would see a battle between the Catholics and the Protestants. But in France, a new sect of Calvinism would take root. And you would see a clash between the Catholic and the Huguenot. The Huguenot were named after one of the leaders in Geneva, who in the Wars of Capel, he actually led a political revolt and would basically seize control of the city. Based on Hugh. So, while this was essentially a Calvinist movement, it was less Calvinist and kind of a little more Zwingli. So it was like a blend of the two. But, don't forget, Calvinism doesn't matter. Calvinism has a local component. So you can take basically the blueprint and you can superimpose it over your community. And you can tailor it as you want. Because it's a locally controlled religion. You don't have an institution like the Catholic Church, where everything comes from Rome, top down. But from its inception, it was less of a religion, like theology, and more of like a socio-economic protest. Many people in France had become angered at the oppressive system in which the French kings held over the people. There were high prices, there were high rents, high taxes, inflation. And the peasants frequently rioted against nobles. So, many of the peasants, about 15% of the population, converted and became a Huguenot, a form of a protest. But the weird dynamic was that the nobles themselves would also use this quote-unquote religion as a form of political resistance. It is estimated that 50% of the French nobles converted. So only about 15% of the overall population, but when you have half of the nobles, then obviously you have those nobles wanting more and more and more, going against the Catholic nobles who want more and more and more. And the monarchy is kind of sandwiched in between. And the nobles convert. Now, on these teams, two families in particular would rise to the surface and would kind of come to resent or reflect the movements. On the Huguenot side, they were led by a powerful French family located in southern France in lands close to the Spanish border. The Bourbon. The Guy, the Catholics, were led by a powerful northern German dynasty, family, whatever you want to call them, known as Guise.
The Bourbon strength was economics. A lot of food was grown down there. And they had good trade relations. But the Guise were, because of their proximity to Paris, had been loyal supporters of the crown going back to the Hundred Years' War. So, as a result, the head of the family, the Duke, that position, typically was the commander-in-chief of the French army, by default. And two of the Duke's brothers made up two of the eight French cardinals. So they had political, military, and of course, religious authority. Well, here's the thing. You take the nobles, split them in half, and both halves want the same thing. They want to be close to the crown. Why? More power. More access. More influence. All right. Questions so far. Now, obviously, a family's influence over the king really depends upon who the king is. Typically, older kings, more experienced kings, are less likely to listen or need the advice and counsel of the nobles. But every few years, obviously, there's a change when a current monarch dies and he is replaced by his son. And that's essentially what would happen in France. In 1559, Henri II, who had been king for nearly 13 years, died. In a nasty, nasty way. See, Henri, like kings of his day, had made an arranged marriage in hoping to heal the divisions of the wars of Maurice of Saxony. He arranged for one of his daughters to marry the now King of Spain, Charles V's son, Philippe. But to celebrate, they held a tournament. Oh, man. The tournaments of old. They featured eating and drinking and merriment, feats of strength. But the highlight was the joust. Talk about alpha maleness. You get on a big war horse, hundreds of pounds, capable of speeds. How fast can a horse go? They can go like 30 miles an hour, can't they? You're riding on the horse, and you're facing off a guy down the other end of a straightaway. But to keep you alive, of course you're going to wear plate mail armor. 100 pounds of steel. You're armed with a lance. A long pole. You also have a shield. Now, the goal in a joust is not to pee your pants. Race down the line, and you are basically going to out-masculate your opponent. Because if he chickens out, pulls away, you win. But if he's in it as well, then you're going to use your lance, and at the least, you want to knock his shield out of his arm. or you want to disarm him. At best, you're going to knock him off his horse.
Miles an hour, 100 pounds of steel, long pole, shield, helmet, visor, tiny little eye slots. Race it down.
In order to deflect your opponent's lance, you cannot be limp-wristed. You have to securely hold your shield and angle it so that way when the lance hits it, it basically slides off and goes wide. Well, on this day, to celebrate the marriage of his daughter, the king decides he's going to participate. Because he has testicular fortitude of Herculean levels. He's in there. He's racing down the lines, going against one of the nobles. And for some odd reason, he angles his arm, probably unknowingly, in a way that doesn't deflect, but rather is angled up. The lance hits the shield. In a fraction of a second, slides upwards and penetrates him right through the eye hole in his visor. Falls off the horse, dead. It's all fun and games until someone gets a lance in the eye. But no worries. Even though the king was dead, no worries. He performed his kingly duty. And he had several sons. So, in 1559, his oldest son, Francois the second, would be crowned king. But the problem is he was 15 years old. So obviously he needed a regent until he could rule in his own name, which at the time I believe the law of France said 20. Well, because the nobles were divided, half Catholic, half Huguenot, they kind of compromised, and they all kind of agreed that the best person to serve as regent was the queen, Marie de Medici. Catherine de Medici. Medici, as in the Florentine banking family. What's the big deal? Well, she's Italian, not French. So, knowing the way monarchies work, she, of course, wanted to make sure her son could get married and start procreating to secure the dynasty. Interestingly enough, she would arrange a marriage with the daughter of King James the Fifth. Fourth? Maybe the fourth. I don't know, the King of Scotland. Yeah, let me see. I think it was King James the Fifth. And what was her name? Mary. Mary Stuart. Well, Francois was 15, Mary was 16. She comes to France, this little Scottish princess, converts to Catholicism, and tries to survive in French court life. I don't recall if they consummated the marriage. But nonetheless, it doesn't matter. Because shortly after Francois turned 15, he got a really bad earache that turned into an abscess, a big inflammation that went all the way down to his brain, and he died. Poor Mary would be shipped back to Scotland, which would be fine, because eventually she would become Mary, Queen of Scots. But now, in less than 2 years, we have two kings dead. And obviously, Francois had no heir. He was a kid. But no worries, as I said, Henri did his kingly duty. There was a spare. 9-year-old Charles IX would take the throne in 1560, shortly after the death of his brother. Now, it would be during his reign that tensions between the Huguenots and the Catholics would erupt. In total, over the course of his 14-year reign, there would be 3 separate wars. The first war, the Catholics would attack first. Apparently, the Huguenot leadership plotted to abduct the king and try to convert him to Protestantism. But of course, there was no proof that it went beyond just the planning stage. But nonetheless, the Catholic armies in the north mobilized and marched south and battled against the Protestant armies in the south. But it ended up being a draw. Neither side won. The queen steps in and tries brokering a settlement. Then a few years later, a second war erupted. This time, it was the Huguenots that preemptively attacked the Catholics, because there were rumors going around that the Catholics were planning to invade the South. Again, they may have been plotting it, but there was no actual fact that they were preparing. But that's what happens when you listen to gossip. Well, in that second war, while it was kind of technically a draw, the Huguenot actually got an advantage. They managed to seize a couple of Catholic provinces. So, technically a draw, but advantage Huguenot. Then the third war erupted when the Catholics refused to recognize the terms that ended the second war. But in the third war, it expanded because foreign powers got involved. Because France was one of the most powerful nations on the continent. And if you could rip France in half, you would eliminate that threat. The Protestants, the Huguenots, got support from the English and the Dutch. And the Catholics got support from Spain and Tuscany and the Pope. But interestingly enough, the third war ended like the second. Technically a draw, but advantage Huguenot. Now, ultimately, what started and instigated these things was the queen. She was meddling in politics. She was the one stoking up everyone's fears. She was the one spreading gossip. Now, she was doing this in part to help keep her son on the throne. But all she did was instigate both sides. Particularly when, in 1572, after
after the Third War took place,
she arranged a marriage between her daughter, Margaret, and the leader of the Bourbon, Henri Bourbon.
But to compensate the Catholics, the crown paid the Catholics for the damage they suffered in the Third War. So again, she's trying to play both sides. But now here's a problem.
Now suddenly you have a Protestant that is potentially in line for the crown. And if a Protestant becomes king, look at what happened in England. So, in retaliation, one of the worst massacres in French history erupted.
On August 24th, 1572, on St. Bartholomew's Day,
on August 18th, 6 days before, Margaret and Henri had gotten married, and all of the Huguenot nobles were in the city celebrating. On August 22nd, Paris was put on lockdown when there was two assassination attempts, one against Henri and one against Charles.
The one against Charles was a fallacy because they were trying to trigger the lockdown. Because once the city was locked down, all of the Protestant nobles' troops were locked out of the city. And all of the guards that were guarding the city were all Catholics.
So early in the morning, when all of the Huguenots went to Mass to celebrate St. Bartholomew's Day, the call went out and the Catholics literally began going house to house, building to building, slaughtering the Huguenot wherever they could find them. Out of sheer luck, Henri managed to slip out of the city. But nearly 3,000 Huguenot nobles were killed in Paris.
And then, all throughout France, the Catholic forces went on the offensive, slaughtering anywhere between 20 and 40,000 Huguenot in a 3-day period.
Well, when this erupted, it ignited a Fourth War. A war that would last nearly 2 decades. And that war is known as the War of Three Henrys.
Questions so far?
Why three Henrys? Well, very simple. In 1574, Charles IX died, heirless. And he would be succeeded by his younger brother, who just so happened to be named Henri. Oh, wait, back.
Henri III.
Well, coincidentally, the leader of the Guise, the Duke of Guise, also was named Henri. And as we know, the leader of the Bourbon were also known as Henri. Hence, the War of the Three Henrys. Now, there was a problem. Henri III was an experienced king. And when his brother Charles died of tuberculosis, he had been in Poland, where he had been king for 10 years. But the problem was, he had been there so long, he forgot really how to speak French. So he comes back and he's anointed king of France, same time he's king of Poland, but he doesn't speak the language. Effectively. He doesn't know the ways of the court. So he has to trust. He has to trust
the person who his mother suggested he trusts, Henri de Guise.
Well, in the wake of the St. Bartholomew's massacre, like I said, there was this state of war. The smallest thing could trigger actual battles.
Tensions, however, began to rise the longer Henri III was king.
Why? Well, even though he was king, even though he was married, he failed to produce an heir. It's possible that his swimmies were not swimming. It's possibly that it was something on the queen's side. It's also possible that he really wasn't interested in his wife, because he was sleeping around. He did father a couple of bastard kids. And on top of that, it's also rumored that he swung from both sides of the fences. But long story short, as time went on, de Guise in particular began freaking out. Because the next potential person in line, because of his marriage to Margaret, would be Henri Bourbon. So, de Guise would make an alliance with Philip II of Spain and would begin starting to engage in palace intrigue, going so far as to suggest that the throne should not go to Henri Bourbon, but rather it should go to Bourbon's uncle, Charles, who happened to be a Catholic cardinal.
To which, of course, Henri Bourbon rejected.
Well, when Henri Bourbon rejected that, de Guise declared war. And armies rallied, and they began taking to the battlefield, and there were pitched battles. There were sieges.
Now, initially during the war, Henri sided with de Guise, allowing the royal troops
to join with the Catholic troops. But, during the war, the Huguenots, or Huguenot, began seeing victories on the battlefield, particularly against the king's forces.
Because the king's forces were not necessarily fighting probably as hard as they could, probably because they didn't want to die.
Plus, the Bourbons used guerrilla tactics. They used primitive explosives to blow up buildings and blow up bridges. They poisoned the well. When the soldiers were marching through the woods, they attacked, you know, at night. As the war erupted, Swiss Protestants, German Protestants, soon invaded France to help out the Bourbons. But de Guise managed to drive the foreigners out. Leading de Guise in 1588 to make a fateful decision. The only way to save France was to depose Henri, and claim the throne for himself. But the king learns of De Guise's plan to assassinate him. He managed to sneak out, get out of the city. And when he did, he quickly traveled south and kind of did the enemy of my enemy is my friend deal and sided with the Bourbon. Now, why would Henri accept him? Well, Henry basically said, look, I'd be willing to impose Curius Regeo Eos Religio. To which Henri basically said that would be fine. And by the way, Henri also, the king, also said, which Henri Bourbon agreed, that he'd be willing to pardon all of the Catholics except for De Guise. Which Henri Bourbon said that would be a wise move. Because we didn't want to fight. He was fighting for survival. When word of this spread, De Guise was caught in Paris and would be assassinated. Because there were many amongst the Catholics that were tired of this decades-long conflict. They were tired of the now hundreds of thousands of people who died, the billions of dollars of money that was spent. And all they're doing is just decimating the French countryside. Well, when the king learns that De Guise is dead, he quickly would march towards Paris, hoping to retake the city and essentially take back the throne. And by the way, the Parisians willingly were ready to surrender. But as the king was preparing to move on the city, they were in a camp several miles outside the Parisian walls. A fanatical Dominican friar by the name of Jacques Clément would show up in the king's camp, claiming to carry important information for the king. Well, he had fake papers, which seemed to imply that he was actually a representative of the Catholic faction, which is why they allowed him into camp to begin with. And then for some reason, the guards didn't take the papers that he had to the king. Instead, they allowed him to go personally to the king. Well, as the monk walks up face to face with the king, holding a bundle of documents, the king reaches out to get the documents, but he's not paying attention to Jacques' other arm hidden in his robes. As the king reaches out, exposing his flank, the friar thrusts a dagger into the king's side and does some of this. The king is mortally wounded. He would die several hours later. Now, according to popular myth, Jacques, before he killed the king, bent his head forward and whispered something in his ear. No one heard what he said. But the guards, when they saw what he did, didn't take Jacques into custody. They whipped up their swords and they killed him on the spot. So we'll never know. But now, all we know is that De Guise is dead and Henri III is dead.
Well, in the end, Henri Bourbon would be named king.
But as bad as the wars of Charles V was, they paled in comparison to the wars between the Catholics and the Huguenots in France.
For nearly 30 years, the Catholics battled the Huguenots. It is estimated that over 500,000 French men, women, children died in the wars.
Plus, another 500,000 fled.
The French economy was shattered. And the ruling family, which dates all the way back to the beginning of the Hundred Years' War with Philip VI, the Valois, came to an end. And in the end, the nobles basically decided, and the Catholics agreed, the best way to heal France, I will give it to the victor, Henri Bourbon. He was crowned King Henri IV. He would be the founder of the last ruling dynasty of France, the Bourbon dynasty. By the way, while the Bourbons were eliminated in France in 1840, the current king of Spain, Philippe VI, is one of his descendants. Why was he accepted, though? Well, he made the political move. Even though he was a Calvinist, because the majority of France was Catholic, he declared himself willing to convert to Catholicism. But to bind his people together, like Elizabeth in England did, he would pass in 1598, a law that remained in place for nearly 70 years, the Edict of Nantes. Now, this was not based on Curius Regio, Eos Religio. This went further. While it did not give Protestants full freedom, this edict declared toleration for the Protestants. And they did receive legal protections. The most significant was it would be a crime to attack Protestant churches. It would be a crime to assault someone who was Protestant, just because they were Protestant. But here's the irony. By the time the Edict of Nantes was passed, it was too little, too late. While when the wars began, 15% of the population was Protestant, 50% of the nobles were Protestant, by the time the Edict of Nantes was passed, 90% of the French Protestant population was either dead or they left the country. Protestantism was essentially eradicated. And France would officially remain a Catholic state all the way up until the French Revolution.
Had they paid attention to what happened in Switzerland, they could have avoided nearly a million lives impacted.
Questions? Chaos in Germany, chaos in France. What about in England? Oh yeah, chaos would reach England as well.
But unlike what happened in Germany and France, where it was basically a civil war, for Elizabeth,
she didn't face a threat internally. As we said, she managed to bring everyone in England together.
If you were Protestant, you thought you went to a Protestant mass. If you were Catholic, you thought you went to a Catholic mass. Everyone was legally tolerated. Live where you want. Focus on being English first. But the problem Elizabeth had was external.
Bless you, Elizabeth.
External threats. One, from her legal heir, and one from her brother-in-law. The legal heir first. Oh, look. Humble. Mary Stuart, Queen of Scots. Mary was a Protestant until she went to France when she got married to Francois II. There she converted to Catholicism. And she kept her Catholicism when she went back to Scotland and became queen. But she kept her Catholicism quiet because by the time she came, much of Scotland had embraced Calvinism. If you are a Presbyterian, you are a Scottish Calvinist. How is she Elizabeth's heir? Well, it goes back to the Act of Succession passed by Henry VIII. Mary was the granddaughter of Henry VIII's sister, who went and married James, King of Scotland. Now, here's the irony. Mary was younger, and had she just waited, it's possible she could have become queen. But she didn't want to wait. She publicly proclaimed that Elizabeth was illegitimate when she became Queen of England. Because if you recall, I told you way back when Henry VIII killed Anne Boleyn, he declared Elizabeth to be a bastard. Now, granted, he restored her legitimacy, but in the eyes of the church, she still was illegitimate. She also, Mary, attempted to stir up trouble with the Catholic nobles. Sent them letters encouraging them to resist Elizabeth. Don't give in to her niceties. Don't give in to her compromises. Organize. Try killing her. By the way, if you ever see, I think, Kate Blanchett, I think that's the actress that was in it. There were two Elizabeth movies. Watch the first one, and this is the time period we're dealing with. There would be multiple assassination attempts on the young queen. But before any assassination attempts would work on Elizabeth, Mary got herself into a bit of problems. Why? Well, not trying to be offensive to my ladies who are present, but she likes sleeping with dudes. And she likes sleeping with lots of dudes. What's the phrase? Body count. And the problem is a lot of the Scottish nobles didn't like having a queen that was a whore. Because every time she had a new lover, she started giving him, like, lands and titles and positions of power, and that person would stay there until she got the new lover. So there was a lot of turnover, there was a lot of controversy. So eventually it got so bad that the Scottish nobles said to the queen, "Get out!" And they named her one-year-old or three-year-old son, maybe three-year-old, one-year-old son, James, as King of Scotland. So, now, she can't go back to Catholic France, because by the time this occurred, her husband is dead, and Charles IX is there, and there's wars going on during the reign of Charles IX. She can't stay in Scotland. There's only one place she can go. She appeals to Elizabeth, who granted her sanctuary.
Set her up in a palace, made sure she had clothes, made sure she had food, made sure she had guards to protect her.
She would be allowed to go out of the palace, she could walk around the grounds, and under certain circumstances, she would be allowed to, like, go public places. But, despite this generosity, and by the way, Elizabeth knew what Mary had been trying to do. Despite the generosity of the queen, Mary screwed it up again. She would send a secret message to none other than the Pope, making a pledge that if the Pope helps her overthrow Elizabeth, she would restore England to the Catholic world. The Pope at the time was, out of all the popes that we've had, if you're a Catholic, this is my favorite name, Sixtus the Fifth. And why do I love this name? Well, 65, dude.
I'm hoping someday that there's a Sixtus the Sixth. That would be epic.
Well, the Pope gets this and, like, okay, he sees what's going on in Germany that resulted in the Peace of Augsburg and Chaos Regio, Eos Religio. Protestantism kind of entrenched in northern Germany. He sees what's going on in France, and the Catholics and the Protestants are killing one another, and it's not looking too good. So for Sixtus, this would be an opportunity for the restoration of a Catholic country. So, of course, he's all in. He reaches out to none other than Philip II of Spain and tells Philip, if you help Mary, you will have my blessing.
Unfortunately for Mary, all of the people who she thought she could trust
were spies planted by Elizabeth.
And every single message that was sent was intercepted, copied, and presented to the queen. Well, when word came back from Sixtus, there's all the evidence that they needed. They put her on trial for treason, conspiring against the queen.
She was convicted, and she would lose her head.
But what about Philip?
Well, Philip's all in. Why would you not be? He's the king of Spain. He's the king of Central America. He's the king of South America. He's the king of the Caribbean. And he's the king of the Philippines. Why would he not want more, more, more? Especially, he's also a devout Catholic. So if he could restore Catholicism to England, that would be wonderful. So when he gets word that Mary is killed, of course he's going to use that as justification, because a Protestant queen killed a Catholic queen. And he would claim the throne as his own. On what right did this king of Spain have to claim the English throne? No?
Who was he married to at one point? Mary Tudor, Elizabeth's older half-sister, who had been Queen of England.
FYI,
the laws of marriage until the 20th century were rooted on the concept of what is known as unity. Essentially, when a man married a woman, all that they had separately were merged together. They were no longer considered separate beings, but they were considered one. But under the law, the man owns everything. So Philip essentially makes the claim that the throne should not have gone to Elizabeth, it should have gone to him, because his wife died. And in death, the possessions of the wife, by law, become the possessions of the husband. Now, of course, the English people did not accept this whatsoever. So when the English people did not sit back and say, yeah, let's make Philip our king, Philip decided to use the blessings of the Pope. And she started interfering with Elizabeth. Assassination attempts, trying to encourage rebellion. All the same while, Elizabeth, using privateers, English ships capturing Spanish galleons on the Atlantic, each side pushing against the other, until the Pope comes in and says, wipe her out. This would give rise to the reason why the lost colony of Roanoke occurred. Because in 1558, Philip would launch the largest fleet in Spanish history. 130 ships staffed with 25,000 soldiers. They were going to plan a reverse D-Day. They were going to sail to the English coast, offload into the English countryside, and basically march to London. But in the end, the Spanish armada was shattered. You can read that on your own because I don't have them all. Essentially, the winds, a storm would erupt in the English canal, and about one-third of the ships, one-third of the men, died. In the end, Philip would attempt to build a second armada, but the first armada nearly bankrupted Spain. So the second attack never came. But ironically, by trying to invade England, ultimately this is what solidified both the English Catholics and the English Protestants supporting the Queen. Because both sides answered the call, because neither wanted to be invaded by the Spanish. Now, what's significant of that line? Well, this is where I'm going to leave you. This would be the first time in English history where a political decision was made not based in any way, shape, or form on religion. Of national interests. So this in part is one of the reasons why Elizabeth today is regarded as one of the most beloved monarchs of all time. She didn't care if you were Catholic, she didn't care if you were Protestant. It was just about being English. Questions? All right, when we come back, we're going to deal with the mother of all religious wars, and then we're going to switch over to politics. See y'all later.
Ooh, right at time. 1 hour and 15.